Hey friends, mark your calendars. The Intentional Motherhood Retreat is coming up October 23rd through 25th in Portland, Oregon. It's a meaningful few days to slow down, connect, and refocus on what matters most in your motherhood journey. Also, some exciting news, Intentional Fatherhood has officially launched on all podcast platforms, including YouTube. So go subscribe, check out the first few episodes, and share it with all the fathers in your life. For more details and registration info for the Motherhood Retreat, you can go to intentionalparents.org, or you can go check out our new website for fathers, intentionalfatherhood.org. Welcome to the Intentional Parents Podcast. Intentional exists to help parents in their God-given task to raise passionate Jesus followers. We exist to bring hope, help, and healing to families. Each week, we will talk about anything from parenting, marriage, lifestyle, and what it looks like to follow Jesus in our time. Intentional is made up of Phil and Diane Comer and Brooke and Elizabeth Moser. I am Brooke, and the funny thing is, we are all family. Elizabeth is Phil and Diane's daughter, so we're a family figuring this thing out together. We hope this podcast feels like you're sitting with us in our home talking about how to do this thing called life together. Elizabeth and I are your hosts. Let's get into this week's podcast. Welcome back to the Intentional Parents Podcast. Again, we want to say thank you for following along. Thank you for listening and taking any time out of your day, wherever you're at, to listen. As a reminder, please, if you get a moment, go to our podcast page, rate the podcast if it has blessed you or spoken to you at all. And also, if you wouldn't mind leaving a comment of how this is actually specifically speaking to you, we would just love that. Today, we have a wonderful episode because you, the listener, have fueled us with questions, lots of questions that we are answering. And so we did an episode just a little bit ago on all of your questions, and we had so many, we just decided, hey, let's do a second episode and let's keep answering these questions because they were so good and have been such a good way to engage with some of the things that you, the listener, are going through right now. So with that, I have Elizabeth and Phil and Diane here, and we're excited to answer some questions today, aren't we, guys?
Yep.
Yeah.
Ready to go.
Ready to go. So we're going to start with a question. Number one, it's going to be a pretty quick one, but a great question for many of you listening. And here it is. How should first-time parents be preparing for parenting during pregnancy?
Great question.
That's a great question. Yes.
It seems like most parents prepare for birth during pregnancy, but don't think about what's ahead for the next lifetime.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this. Did you guys prepare? I mean, like, you guys decided, you got married. How long was it before you had John Mark?
2 years.
Let's see. Less than
2 years.
2 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I like to joke that, you know, if you're in a solid Jesus-honoring church, most pastors, you know, who do weddings won't perform that wedding unless you've been through premarital counseling. Yeah. But up until real recently, when it comes to having a kid, there's no training. You're on your own. And there's a bigger adjustment when you have a child come into your life, I think, even than getting married, don't you guys?
Yes.
I mean,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and your life will never be the same in a good way. Yeah. But, you know, you'll never go anywhere again without thinking of your little boy or your little girl. So,
We really had nothing.
And we read Dobson. Well, mostly you read.
Maybe I
read
after, little pieces, I don't parts think before. Of it.
Maybe not even before. But, you know, by God's grace, we had great parents. And so I think that helped us. But I think had we not, we would have made a lot more mistakes. But I like to say that's not the way to do it. The way to do it is before you get married, learn as much as you can about marriage before you get married so you can do it God's way out of the gate. And the more you know about raising kids before you have one, the better. Mm-hmm. And so this is a smart person who asked this question. The fact that they're even thinking about how do I prepare to raise a son or daughter is really smart. So I think half the battle is won that they're asking the question. You know?
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. This shows an intentionality that I'm not just feeding and clothing my child. But then it's actually this child is my responsibility. So number one thing I think that you need to do to prepare is to read and talk to mentors, you know.
Yes.
Look around your church, look around your community, the people in your circle, and say, whose parenting style seems to be something that I could see myself sort of imitating? Because really, that is what a lot of discipleship is. And we had this amazing couple who lived around the corner from us who are still, so what is John Mark, 40?
Yeah.
40 years later, they are still our mentors. And now they live a few hours away from us.
Talking
and
about
they
Bill
speak
and Lori.
Into yeah. our yeah. lives. Absolutely. And they're speaking into your
oh,
lives.
Oh, yeah. We call them all the time. They're in their mid-80s. And we're like,
but the thing is, we looked at their kids.
Yes.
And, you know, we said, I hope our kids turn out sort of like their kids.
Yeah.
So you look ahead at somebody who has a proven product and you say, they're doing something right.
Yes.
And then what we like to say is, don't hope that they call you someday.
Yes.
Approach them, which Diane did, approach Lori and said, can we get together?
Our mentors were Bill and Lori Kies, and there's nobody like them, and I won't share them with anybody else. So no address or telephone number.
We had Glenn and Patty Miller a little bit, too.
We had others.
We had others, but they
lives.
Were our primary and still are. Yeah,
yeah they That's were, amazing. And they helped us tremendously. The other thing is, I feel like people have discipled me through their books.
Yeah.
I love to read. And so you can, you know, a lot of times a book or two, most people only write a few books, you know, one or two or three, and they're giving you their best. This is like what their life is about. They're pouring it into a book, but always read with discernment. You know, everything has to check up with the Word of God. Does this really connect with God in this way? I would be careful about reading about the development of children from a secular book because their whole worldview is so different.
Yeah.
Not saying you wouldn't, you know, certainly feeding and physical things, but I'd be careful about the emotional life of a child apart from Christ.
Yeah. What are two books you'd recommend if this person was listening, like, hey, I want to read some stuff. What are some books you'd recommend?
Well, there's one that I think is just, as far as just principles, not super practical, but really, you need to get those principles in, especially it's a good time when you're pregnant. And it's by Paul Tripp.
Paul David Tripp. Yep.
And what's the title? But we just
it's
looked at
14. It's Parenting, 14 Gospel Principles That Can Radically Change Your Family.
Yes. Okay. And these are 14 principles straight from the scriptures that you can form your ideals and your ideas about raising children and your family, doing your family together.
Yep.
And they're not principles for infants or for elementary or teenagers or even adult children. They're for the whole thing, for you as a family. I think that's a read well worth it. He's a very well-known and well-thought-of counselor, one of the premier counselors, I would even say, has a counseling center and teaching center. And this is not only the scriptures, but a long life of experience of seeing how we mess up our kids and helping us to avoid some of those things. So.
Yeah.
This is good.
You know, the only other thought I had is, you know, sometimes parents are like rightly so fearful, like the fear of God. Like I remember you said the first time you held John Mark, like this is
you
feel all this love, but this is a person who's completely dependent on me.
Exactly.
But I like to say they don't pop out as a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
And so you know, something, you know, you have some time in here. Like I remember when we did our first parenting conference at our church, you know, and gazillion people showed up and this one couple was there and they were pregnant. They were all excited. Like, oh, you guys, oh yeah, we can't wait. We're pregnant. And, you know, and then, we had to do it again, actually a couple times within a year because so many people were interested. And I saw them again sitting through it a year later. I go, you guys are back. We're telling the same stories. Aren't you bored? They go, oh no, we were pregnant then. We have a 1-year-old. We got all kinds of questions.
Yes,
you know?
Of course.
So I just think it's a joy and there's a process and it's a daily thing. And I love that you brought up the scriptures because the Bible's filled with wisdom on raising kids.
Also, though, you can't say this, but I can. The book you wrote, Raising Passionate Jesus Followers, is also really helpful, practical, all biblical. So we'll put both those books in the show notes for sure.
And the truth is, much of what we put in that book, we stole from our mentors with their permission, but also just from so many other sources of wisdom.
Yes.
And I would say be wary of what all your friends are doing. Yes, you listen to each other, but until somebody has had a chance to make some mistakes and is willing to share those mistakes with you, a tried and true method when somebody has maybe the oldest is a 10-year-old is probably just, it just needs a little time to percolate. And it, and that parent needs a little bit of time to be able to look back and say, okay, this was a mistake.
Yeah,
it was an ideal. It sounded good at the time. We made plenty of those unfortunate mistakes.
We already are making plenty of those. So,
and gladly really pass them on as warnings to you.
Yeah. So I love that. Well, thank you for answering that question. The second question, right here is, how do I implement the box with a headstrong 2-year-old? Now, if you're not familiar with the box, you can go back in previous episodes. We did a whole series. We did 4 episodes on the box, and I'll put those in the show notes as well, so you can make sure to listen through if you're like kind of unfamiliar with the box. So we're not going to explain it here, but there's a reference point for you. But how would we implement the box with a headstrong 2-year-old? And if you are not familiar, remember the bottom of that box is Jesus. One of the sides is order. Another side is discipline. And then the top of that box, Phil, what's the top of that box?
Affection, affirmation, and you and me. Fun.
Yeah.
You got to have some fun with your kids. They're a gift.
Fun. So it's a box to help. It's a model to help direct your kids. So how do we do this with a 2-year-old specifically?
Well, this
we have one.
Has one of those right
Mom's
now.
Mom's looking at me. I have a headstrong.
Yeah, how do you do this, Elizabeth? You once were one.
Well, we find a box, a real box. No, I'm just kidding.
You find a real box.
We find a real box.
Put him in. For a minute sometimes.
You leave the top open so they can get out. But listen, you just put... No, I'm just kidding. That's not the box.
First of all, you have to remember the reason for the box was because I started to feel like a policeman. All day long, disciplining, correcting, rebuking, you know, talking to our kids about misbehavior. It seems like it was such a negative way to go through my day that I thought, okay, so there has to be a better way, because I think I'm in this for years of correcting and discipline. So that's what kind of got the ball rolling on the concept of the box. Now, Elizabeth, give us a day in the life of a 2-year-old and the box.
This is my current reality. But I will say, we get a lot of questions about the box and people really wanting practical examples. And I totally get that. I am like, okay, yeah, that sounds great. How do I actually do that? And I think whenever we think about coming up with specific examples, it's even hard for us to give them sometimes.
Yeah.
But I think a way to look at the box, rather than it's this tool that is measurable and linear and we can see it and decide, okay, I'm going to use this tool right now. There are some moments where it does feel that way and you see the areas that you can immediately implement all 4 sides in a situation. But more often than not, and I think especially with a 2-year-old and the younger years, I think it's important to look at it through the lens of, this is a lens in which I parent through. Meaning, over the course of a day, with a 2-year-old, there's going to definitely be some discipline. Like, you can't avoid that. That there's definitely going to be discipline. But over the course of that day, you're making sure there's not just discipline, but that you're talking about Jesus, singing about Jesus, that they have little books that talk about Jesus, that you have that throughout their day, that you have some sort of order and structure throughout their day, because no 2-year-old thrives on a chaotic schedule. They just don't. And obviously you're going to have days where there's less structure, but then that you're also incorporating times of fun and play and encouragement. We've talked about this a lot, where encouragement is such a helpful tool. And especially there's certain ages where it doesn't seem like it would be effective, like when they're 2. And yet it's so effective. Sloan is incredibly strong-willed and loud, and you know, she's not a mild bone in her body. We thought we finally got one mild-mannered child, because she was the easiest baby on the planet. And then she turned 1, and it was like she might as well have turned 2 and just skipped 1 to 2.
She lets no... She will take... No, like no prisoners. Her older siblings, no, oh my goodness.
They her name do means not. Warrior, and it's very fitting to her personality, which is wonderful. It's just difficult when she's 2. But encouragement works hugely for her. If she just even looks like she might possibly obey what I asked her to do, and we encourage her, and I'm so proud of you, Sloan. Good job. You put the toy away when I asked you to, you know, just over the top. She stands up straighter and she goes and picks up the rest of the toys.
It's so excited. Yes.
So I know that's still kind of like ethereal and not
I think that's really helpful.
But I think if you can look at it through that lens, and then there'll be moments when you see that you're implementing it in that moment. But it's almost more that you look back on the day and even ask yourself, like if you could get in this practice of asking yourself, okay, did I evenly implement all four sides today? Or did I just go to town on discipline and I'm forgetting all the others? Or did I go to town on fun and now my two-year-old's ruling the roost? Or, you know?
That's right.
So I think, yeah, it's just even something that if you can even at the end of your day say, did I have somewhat of a balance of doing all of them? And if you did, then you're doing a great job. And if you didn't, you have tomorrow to balance out the other. That is a great way to answer
because I was thinking, I don't actually, because that's true. I think a lot of people, and I can even do this sometimes, you think, well, the box, you have to hit all four sides in this one moment. And that's not really what it is. It's more of a metrics. But I agree. Like, it's interesting, just a real story with Sloan specifically. At night when you lay her down, she always has this moment. It kind of seems to be her thing where she just kind of is fussy. She doesn't need anything. She doesn't want anything. She's
She starts asking for things. I need water. I need Duke to say goodnight.
Exactly. But I then I say, I'm like, okay, I see this game. Here's a drink of water. No, you've said goodnight to everyone. You had your round. Totally going to sleep now. And it's at that moment where she's like, you know, fussy. And there's a lot of times where it's like, Sloan, you need to obey, go to sleep. And, you know, kind of getting more firm, like, no, I said, you need to go to sleep. And it's so funny. So the other night, I just decided to pick her up and just hold her and just hold her really close. Like, Dad loves you. I'm not mad at you. I just need you to go to sleep. It's not a big deal. And she just laid down, didn't say, make a peep. And it was a great room. It was like this. She just wanted like closeness, reassurance. And now some of you are going to go like, well, that I do that all the time. And for some of us, maybe we're a little slower to it. But I think with Sloan as an example, it's amazing how she responds tenfold better with positivity, encouragement. She does need discipline, but she needs far less than I think sometimes we're even needing to give her.
So another aspect of the box that we haven't talked too much about, but I think is really important for a two-year-old, is that mom and dad are both implementing the box pretty evenly.
Yeah.
Otherwise, what ends up is some really lopsided parenting where one is a disciplinarian and usually the order person and is keeping, you know, the child away from sugar overloads or from making sure the nap happens and making sure the discipline happens. And the other is all about fun and affection.
Yeah.
And it's almost like becomes a competition. Really important for the person who does not like to discipline to really learn the skills of discipline and to implement that, because otherwise your fun is going to be counterproductive to the actual development of the child. So if you could both be doing the box, encourage each other, like, and, you know, maybe the rules person, the disciplinarian order person might need to be reminded that that child really needs your affection and really needs to be held and cuddled and tickled and have fun and be rocked.
And I think that's where if you can communicate with each other and lovingly call it out in each other when either of you are in excess. Because that's our dynamic.
Done that before.
Yeah.
I don't know what you're talking
even
about.
Like the other day, one of our kids was having a moment and Brooke was going upstairs to take care of it. And I stopped him really quick and I said, just so you know, I've been really hard on him today because it's been a hard day. So go mild and try to encourage him.
Okay.
That's the box right there.
There it is.
Like, I'm aware of what's been happening throughout the day. He hasn't been home.
Really good.
We still need to address the behavior of this child. But if I've been kind of hard on him all day and he needs the other sides of the box and then Brooke goes up and does the same thing, we're not really going to get anywhere.
And those little moments are really helpful.
And neither do you want the two-year-old to, you know, hand that two-year-old off to the parent who's just getting home from work.
Yeah.
So there just needs to be this overall balance, and maybe in a day, but in a week as well, just to make sure that you're not doing what I felt like I was doing there for a while, just being the policeman.
Yeah.
And but that you're really, I mean, it's why policemen do community policing, right? Their own version of the box are involved in people's lives, and they, all the studies prove that makes the discipline actually more effective.
Yeah. Hmm. Great answer. Next question. Moving right along. We've got creative ways to ensure your kids are being discipled by people other than their parents. Great question. Yes, great creative question. And what are some of those creative ways to ensure that kids are being discipled by just other people than just their parents?
Yeah. Well, speaking for us, we use two main ways. And then, Elizabeth, you brought up some more. Parenting in community is a huge one. That you are surrounding your kids with other parents who are Jesus followers and who are different than you. They talk about Jesus different than you. They read their Bibles a little different than you. Like, for instance, one of my daughters, Rebecca, is extremely intelligent. You're both extremely intelligent, but
that's okay. She's way smarter than me.
Her faith is largely a thinking faith. We listened to the same message once, and it was all about statistics about creation and how it could have happened and all that. It was all mathematical statistics.
Yeah.
I was completely bored thinking, huh? You know, what is this about?
Yeah.
Well, Rebecca was just almost jumping for joy to see God proven true in such a magnificent, factual kind of way. So it was a clue to me that I needed to get her around people who were a little bit more like her, whereas my faith might be a little bit more mystical and devotional, and it wouldn't necessarily compute for Rebecca. So being around a community, looking at your friends and saying, I remember one specific one saying, I want to connect Rebecca with this girlfriend of mine. You're not threatened by it because you know that she actually can offer your daughter something that she might miss if it's just me.
Yeah.
And the second one is hospitality. Just have people over. I mean, we had the privilege when our kids were little, especially, of being involved in a church that had, you know, a huge missionary base and giving and justice. And so as often as possible, we'd have those people over to our house for dinner and our kids sitting there at the table. And, you know, they tell stories. And I know that that was part of their discipleship in being, this is what it looks for this man or this woman or this family to be all in passionate Jesus followers.
Yeah.
Different than mom and dad. And that appealed to my kids. I can't say anybody actually met with any of my kids when they were young on a weekly basis. But discipleship happens just by almost accidentally.
Yeah, osmosis, almost like you're in the space of people. Yeah.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts I had. You know, I remember, you know, when Elizabeth, when you guys were little, we were on staff at a church of about 1,200 people. So they were like, maybe four of us who were full-time pastors. We each had a major area. I was the worship guy, but because there wasn't only three or four of us or five of us, we all had other areas. And ours, we got the choice between children's ministry or the seniors. So I took the seniors really fast because children's ministry is very time intensive and a lot of work and scheduling. And it was basically this group of women, the guys that all died. There was one guy was still alive, I think.
But he had Alzheimer's,
I think, anyway. But these women were amazing, you know, and they were, you know, I was in my 30s, and, you know, they were old, you know, like, but they were delightful. And so once a month we did an event. You know, we took him to San Francisco and walked out on the Golden Gate Bridge, or we took him out to breakfast. And so we
took him to the Jelly Belly Factory.
To the Jelly Belly Factory, yeah. Yes. So we go on an excursion, but we brought our kids along, and they had a mission. You have to ask them one, what was it, babe? One question?
So they had three questions.
Three questions, okay.
So, and we made up the questions, different ones. Where were you born? We told them not to ask them how old they were. they couldn't quite grasp that question. Something interesting about them. And then at the dinner table that night, We would ask the kids questions. They kind of would started to compete with each other who could ask the best questions and get the most interesting answers. And they learned a lot from
this. Yeah, the thing is that these were people that were had been married 40, 50, 60 years. And so so they're learning stuff. And then the other thing I think we have to remember is that even though we as mothers and fathers are given the primary responsibility for raising our kids in the ways of the Lord, Deuteronomy 6, that's crystal clear. You know, these things I'm commanding you to teach to your children, you know, when you rise up, when you walk. By the way, we're primarily responsible, but it doesn't mean we don't look out and say, man, I need this person's help and that person's help because I'm weak in that. And, you know, even if you're in schooling, sometimes like I need somebody to come in and help tutor algebra or whatever. So, you know, in all different realms, we want to bring the right people in. There's a verse in Proverbs chapter 13, verse 20. It says, he who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm. Another verse, as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. And then in the family of God, we need to be in the church, like in community, because everyone has a spiritual gift and they're all different spiritual gifts. Mm-hmm. And so what's really powerful, I've learned, when your kids, especially when they hit the teenage years, and now you're older a bit. You guys aren't there yet. Duke's your oldest. But, you know, when your kids are like 17, 15, and 13, and you're old, you know, you started hitting that thing where, I don't know if my parents really know anything. When you have a 22-year-old youth pastor or just a godly guy or a godly gal start hanging out with your son or with your daughter, taking him to coffee and saying the same thing you're saying, that's awesome. Really powerful. Of course, it's a disaster if they're saying something different, like your parents are wrong, you know. But when they come in and reinforce, then it helps in their discipleship to Jesus. It reinforces, you know. And then, of course, grandparents, if you've got, that's a dream. If you've got, you know, multiple generations, like, you know, grandma and grandpa, or they call us pops and mama, are saying the same thing my mom and dad are. I mean, they're making sure I read my Bible in the morning too. And then I've got this other person who's that's not amazing. Old like my parents coming in and sharing. So I just feel like that's the way God designed us to do life in community.
I think that's huge. The grandparents thing is huge. And I think that if you, I think we've talked about this before. If you have parents or in-laws who know Jesus and you wish they would play a more active role, that's a role that you can invite them into. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think grandparents just don't know what to do. And so they're waiting. They don't want to overstep. And so it seems like they're not taking a step. But I think that's something you could easily say, hey, mom and dad, you've walked with Jesus for 30, 40 years. I would love for you to just invest some of that wisdom into my kids. Mm-hmm. Or if you have parents or in-laws who don't know the Lord or aren't walking with the Lord, and that's not the type of discipleship you'd want your kids to have, look for grandparents, so to speak, who are older, who can play that role and go after them, get to know them, and ask them to come over for dinner, to spend some time with your family. And I think so often those relationships are going to be formed within the church. Mm-hmm. And I know that we're in a unique time. Nobody's going to church right now because of COVID and all of that. Or maybe, you know, like our church just went to house churches. This would be such an easy time for families to not prioritize church or even, you know, in the post-COVID world when churches start meeting again, to be like, well, we're still watching online or whatever. Yeah. But I think all these relationships, where you're going to find them, where you're going to be most likely to find them is linking arms with people, serving each other within the church. And so I think that's just a beautiful place to form those relationships. But I also think too, like, I think what we've seen in the last couple years is within like cousin relationships. Mm-hmm. Like I'm thinking of my nephew Jude, who's about to turn 15, who has really, really matured in every possible way, sure, but especially spiritually in the last couple years. Mm-hmm. And the influence that he has on our 11-year-old is like nothing I've ever seen before in a positive way. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, not all 15-year-olds are going to be a positive influence. But this relationship is. And so we've started talking recently, okay, how can we don't live near them. How can we prioritize getting them together? Because Duke is better after they spend time together. Because he's spurred on to even just watching, he's watched how Jude navigates conflict.
Okay.
And he's learning how to do that and taking that on at home.
So interestingly enough, there's two things that are going on that are important with that. You see and know his parents well enough, obviously their family, but we know them well enough and appreciate their parenting and go, that's something we want to emulate. Now they are family, so it does make it a little easier, and that's a built-in benefit that's not always true for everybody. We can completely relate with that. But there can be cousin type relationships all over the place where you say, wow, that kid is incredible. I want my kid to be more like that. Let's find time and specifically take energy and time to spend time with that kid. But interestingly enough, I was reading a book recently about the reality that parents don't play as big of a role or as influence their kids as much as peers do. So we've always heard about peer pressure, right? And we do, of course, influence our kids in a huge way. But where they pick up a lot of these social cues, even more than parental advisement or parental influence, is their peers. And they pick up social cues from them. How do I regulate this or navigate, this moment in culture? Well, they see their peers do it. And that can even be with siblings. Like, we see that with even our two, that the way that Duke will set the tone with something, Scarlett implements that and follows. And so anyway, all to say, you're all like, the, it's just kind of an interesting way. One thought that also came to my mind is we interviewed John Tyson a little bit ago, and he did something called Primal Path, which we're going to be doing with Duke. And I know Jude is doing that. And that idea is you grab 10 people that you trust and love, and you handpick these other men for your son. This is Primal Path is specifically for boys, and then he's coming out with one for girls right now. But specifically pick 10 men that you want to influence your son, and then you ask them to come into that. Phil, you're one of those for Jude. I'm one of those for Jude. And then there's like 8 other guys that come together and pour into his life and are available to him in different ways. So anyway, there's a lot of different ways to do that. We just kind of threw out a handful that kind of came to our minds, but I would just encourage you, wherever you're at, be creative about it. And I think that sometimes it's going to be having people over for dinner. Sometimes it's going to be, you know, friendship relationships, cousins, all that kind of stuff. So thank you for that question. That was a great one. In this unique time that we are all finding ourselves in, many of us are doing things that we never thought we would once do. And that even includes cutting our own children's hair. And we want to introduce you to something called Barber Mom. Barber Mom is an online course that teaches parents how to cut kids' hair. Now, there's different modules, and every module has high quality videos and a quiz, so you learn everything you need to know to make your kids look like $1 million while saving $1,000 or more. Now, I don't know about you, but if you have ever tried to cut your own kids' hair at home, this could be and was for us disastrous. We tried to cut Duke's hair, and oh my goodness, it was disastrous. And we are so thankful for Barber Mom. Now, how it works is you'll get a lifetime access to courses that teach you how to cut boys and girls' hair taught by true professionals. You can save lots of money, you can learn a new skill, and you can also know how the hair cutting process actually works and make life easier for you and less stressful for you. We would love to offer this to you. And so all you need to do is go to barbermom.com and use the promo code intentional. Again, that's barbermom.com. Enter the promo code intentional for $10 off a lifetime membership. The next one I want to go to, which is a fun one, it's actually put as one question, but we're going to split it up to two because I actually think it's a really important one to hit. So the question is managing conflict in a big family. So the question is, how do you do that? You know, and the second part of that question is, what is the line between communication and gossip? That's a great question. I think it's really thoughtful. So managing conflict in a big family, if you're a human, if you're in leadership especially, there's constant relational tension is a big part of it. So let's talk about this. Phil and Diane, how did you guys kind of set some of that up? I know we have different ways that we have been processing through some conflict resolution, but how do you manage that in a larger family or in family in general?
Well, I think Phil pretty much set the tone for our family right from the very beginning of transparent, let's get it all on the table. And that's, as we all well know, is still what Phil does. He makes sure that every voice is heard. It's all said decently in an order, but it is said. It must be said. And then followed up until nothing more needs to be said. So, Phil, where in the world did you get that way of thinking yourself that you passed on? And our family still follows your guidance and your leadership in that, and now is imitating it in their own homes.
I don't know. I mean, I think I grew up in a home that was very peaceful.
Yeah.
That wasn't full of yelling or conflict. And, there were my mom was the only, you know, female, because I had two brothers and my dad. Right. So there are four men and my mom. But I think when I came to Christ and he changed my life completely, having grown up in a peaceful home, it's just like, why would there be any yelling or let's just deal with this, you know? And so I don't know. I don't know where I got
but
it.
But your
I know
family
is
that, didn't necessarily deal with it. They were just very kind and nice to each other. but how they managed that, I don't really know. But the fact is, you've made us deal with it. You've brought up the uncomfortable topics instead of let people simmer.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it was the effect of Scripture. You know, it's all over the Scripture in Ephesians 4, be kind to one another. Well, first it says, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Malice is, I want to hurt you. You
know? Yeah.
And so put it all away from you and be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving each other, just as God in Christ also has forgiven you. And so first, when you get married, you have to work that out. So are you going to forgive each other? Are you going to get cold and distant from each other? Are you going to be kind and tender towards one another? And so once you work it out in your marriage, then you start having children, you want to make that the way your family works. And so I think you start off with a biblical lens, like I want our family to function with Jesus at the center, so I need to have him at the center of my life, and Diane needs to have the center of her life. That means we need to get up early in the morning and spend time in the Scriptures so we're walking with God, which hopefully would make us quicker to confess our own sin, and then we want to guide our kids in the way of Jesus and then start living out his way in our home, because this is where you teach biblical principles, is in the home. That's where rubber meets the road, because you're around each other all the time. The reason there's conflict is because we're all broken people. We're all becoming like Jesus, and we're rubbing next to each other. And so there are tempers and there are harsh words spoken. And so solve it. So, you know, and Ephesians says, speak the truth in love. Yep. And so I think that you just deal with the situation, but you deal with it in love. You know, when it comes to gossip, I mean, first of all, gossip is a sin.
Yep.
Okay, it's listed in the New Testament as a sin in Romans chapter 1. It's listed in a list of long list of deeds of the flesh, and right in the midst of it, it says they are gossips, so it's not a good thing. And then 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 20, Paul's talking to the Corinthians. The Corinthians had all kinds of problems in their church. Talk about backbiting, gossip, all kinds of stuff was going on. And he finally says to them, I'm afraid that perhaps when I come, in other words, when I come to see you, I may find you not to be what I wish. You know, and so we want our families, we don't want to find that in our families, right? It may be found by you to be not what you wish, that perhaps there may be strife, jealousy, angry tempers, disputes, slanders, gossip, arrogance, disturbances. And so he's just going on like, I don't want that to be part of the church. And so as a father, and I don't want that to be part of my home either. So you step in and you deal with the situation in love. And so we can talk about how you do that, you know.
So, and I think that Brooke has kind of taken that philosophy into his home, done some real study. I listened to a message at your church that spoke about that. Yeah. You want to walk us through of the... I thought some of it was just so insightful.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, when it comes to the gossip thing, that's always really a tricky one, because it's like, how can you say anything negative about someone and not feel like you're gossiping? And I once heard, it's been so helpful and it's stuck with me ever since, is if you're not a part of the problem or the solution, then it's gossip. And I think that's a great metric, right? If you're a part of the solution, sometimes in a family, you need to go talk to mom about a situation, because really in that moment, she's going to be the one to help bring resolution, or dad, or vice versa. But there's a lot of times where you could share that with a friend or a sibling or a spouse or whatever, and you're realizing they're not going to help anything. Yes. They're just going to fuel my fire.
You're just sounding off.
So that's on gossip. But on the managing conflict part, I think what's been really helpful for me is just to realize you got to deal with it. Like, if you don't deal with it, it's going to affect your relationship.
Sure.
And so I think we all know that, but avoidance of conflict with no effort to resolve it always postpones a proper response, and it usually exacerbates the problem. I mean, we all kind of experience that. And so we have to actually deal with stuff. And I see so many families that use the passive aggressive language, right? We just joke about the problems, but we never...
A little sarcasm.
Yes, and it destroys families, and it just postpones any real unity. And so if you're here and you're listening to this, and the reason you go after conflict resolution is specifically for unity. It's for unity in your relationship and closeness. And if you don't actually deal with it, it will just kind of go in this loop. And I've seen many friends, family as well. It's just like this sarcasm loop of like, let's joke about it. Because if we joke about it, then it's we're kind of letting some of the air out of the tire.
Yeah.
Like we're annoyed, but we're not going to actually talk about this, right? Because it takes a mature, secure person to actually talk about it. And so a couple of the things I think you might be referring to, Diane. There was a couple of things like what is biblical conflict resolution look like? And I think there was a couple of things that I've learned and put together that were just reminders to me. Proverbs 15:1 says a gentle answer deflects anger. Remember that, but a harsh word makes a temper flare. I don't know if you guys have experienced that, but I know Elizabeth and I have. And so first, approach the conversation with a spirit of gentleness. When it comes to conflict resolution, approach it with a spirit of gentleness. Secondly, the second thing you do is have self-awareness. Like there's a good chance you could be wrong. there's a good chance you might've said something in a way, been really passive aggressive, or as we call in our home, aggressive aggressive, just actually in your face. But self-awareness is honestly a true gift, and we all know that. It's a true gift, and it's helpful for any conflict resolution. The third thing was to plan a time for the discussion. So actually make time to plan for to have a discussion. Hey, can I talk? Can we talk in 10 minutes? Hey, can we talk tomorrow? Whatever the thing is.
You mean rather than just spew it all out at the worst on the way to church?
And this is all, by the way, this is all shared from or learned from failure. from not planning a time and just being so overwhelmed with frustration, you just let, you let it spill everywhere. And I think it's that there's another proverb. What is it? Proverbs 17:14. The start of a quarrel is like a leak in a dam. So stop it before it bursts.
Yes. Such good advice.
So plan a time for the discussion. And then before you really talk about it, affirm the relationship. Like, I love you. I care for you. I am frustrated, but I'm not like overly angry and, you know, we can work through this, but I am feeling this, you know, affirm the relationship. And then fifthly, listen carefully, listen to that person, you know, be open to the fact, like maybe I could actually have gotten something wrong. Sixthly, there's only two more. Sixthly, propose a solution. Like, right. If there's something in our marriage, like, okay, I see that this is happening. I'm going to try to do this. To help solve that problem, or so I'm not stepping in that same way again next time. And then lastly, in conflict resolution, forgive. That's huge because I think so often if we don't go through conflict resolution, biblical conflict resolution, we end up just being frustrated. We are so irritated and stuff festers and builds and builds and bitterness takes part. And man, it is just, it's not good. So I think those are a few things that I know that I've been learning and a few things that have been really helpful. And if you're listening, feel free to write those things down. And when you go into, you know, your next conflict, which you will have if you're a human and you're in relationship with other humans, be aware of it and use it, because honestly, there's so much, we all need this. We all need tools to help do this better. None of us have solved this problem. So.
Yeah. And, you know, learning the proper way to apologize, which we have talked about before on this podcast. And maybe you can put that in the show notes, Brooke. Apologies just go a long way to begin the process of restoring what's been broken down between family members. You know, a lot of people think they're apologizing by their actions. But the words really matter, you know. I remember as a teenage girl getting in arguments with my mom and then going off to school, this horrible feeling in my gut, and then coming home and she'd have like new outfit on the, maybe this is why I like clothes so much, laying out for me. But I distinctly remember wishing that she would just say the words. You know, nobody taught her how to say the words. And to her, actions speak louder than words. So I understood that. But the words matter. I'm sorry. It's not your fault. I was just wrong. I shouldn't have talked to you like that. Goes a long way towards
healing.
You know, healing. No excuses. Just, you know, talk about more later. But just saying, I'm just so sorry. I was an idiot.
Yeah, no justification. You're not justifying how you.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny with forgiveness. What I think I'm. you know, you remember in, have you heard that phrase, forgive and forget?
Yeah.
Just forgive and forget. Well, but the hard part is some of the hardest things that have ever happened to you are really traumatic and you can't forget them.
It's not possible.
And what's interesting is in the Bible, we're called to remember from back to front, like remember all the Lord's goodness, remember his faithfulness. Our minds are made to do that. And we have access to our memories. So when people say that, you go, well, that's nice. But I mean, how many people go, I can't forget what this person did or what happened to me in that moment. And to forgive is not to forget, but it's actually to not hold that over someone anymore. Yeah. So what I think people mean in that space is forgive and don't continue to hold that wall of bitterness up against them.
Yeah, that's just so helpful. I mean, hearing it again is really helpful to me. So thank you.
I think too, true, honest conflict resolution where the relationship is restored takes a lot of time. And it takes us, especially if we're trying to do it with each other and trying to teach it to our kids, we have to be willing to take the time to do it. Because especially to take the time to help our kids give a genuine apology. You know, I know parents ask a lot, like, well, but is it okay to make them apologize when they say they don't want to and they're not sorry, you know? But if you stick at the conversation long enough and lovingly help uncover with your child where they erred and what they need to apologize for, they eventually come to realizing, oh, I do need to make things right. But it does take a lot of time, a frustrating amount of time. And I think that that's just important to consider, that if you want to create this family culture that actually does conflict in a healthy way, then you have to sacrifice the time to do so. Yeah. And also, I think, you know, we grew up in a home where there was conflict. You taught us how to resolve conflict. There was conflict all over the place. And yet I was still and still am shocked on how much conflict there is between siblings in our house and how much time it takes to resolve their conflicts. And that's exhausting. And yet I would say it's so, so worth it, because otherwise you create a family culture that either just stuffs negative emotions and doesn't know how to express them, or is sarcastic and cutting and it leaks out that way.
Or you withdraw from your family.
So I'd say that it's so worth it, but it does, it just does take a lot of time. One other thing we've been trying to implement with our kids and trying to use with each other is making I statements, not you statements. And it definitely helps de-escalate conflict faster. We're trying to teach it to our kids rather than, you did this to me and I'm mad at you because you did this. Scarlett, when you did that, it made me feel, I feel like you are disrespecting me.
Yeah.
And it helps just de-escalate the conflict versus putting the other person on the defensive. Yeah. So with our older kids now, we'll say, okay, think for a minute and make an I statement.
Yeah.
When we're trying to get them to communicate with each other to resolve something, we found that to be really helpful.
You know, I thought of another verse, Brooke. You were quoting Proverbs, and Proverbs is so full of wisdom. Every parent needs to read that every day. Every Christian needs to read it every day. But there's this verse in Proverbs 25, verse 23. The north wind brings forth rain, and a backbiting tongue, an angry countenance. And the phrase backbiting tongue in Hebrew is also a tongue of secrecy. So it's talking about gossip here, talking about someone behind their back. So we know that hurts the person, but here it says it hurts us. So it's like we suffer for it. It brings about this angry countenance, and then we start defiling everybody that we're so around. True. So sin always hurts us. And so I just think the more when we see it, and I'm guilty of it, I've you know, sometimes your spouse sees you doing it before you do, right? And so I have a godly wife who will call me on stuff, you know, you know, and I think that I'm being helpful, but actually I'm not, I'm sinning, you know? And so, you know, as quickly as you confess it. But I just think it's good to remember that, you know, and preceding that is a verse talking about how when you heap burning coals on someone's head, you're actually blessing. It sounds like I'm going to put burning coals in your head. No, it goes back to when there were no electricity and your fire went out at night, you'd go next door and say, give me some coals from your fire because my family's freezing. And they'd put some coals in a little basket on your head. You go back and restart your fire. So you're actually doing somebody good. And it says, and the Lord will reward you.
Oh,
and the next verse is, the north wind brings forth rain and a back. So basically when we instead of gossiping about someone, we actually do good for them, it mm-hmm. honors God, and he's actually going to reward us. So,
and then when our kids got married, Phil implemented a standard of relationship that I just think is fabulous. And it wasn't me. I didn't have anything to do with initiating it. But boy, do I love it. That we covenanted together and we told our kids as they were getting married, we would never speak to anyone behind their back. Not to our children, not to our new children, our in-law children. That they could trust that, and that we would not speak to each other complaints that we might have with our kids or our grandkids. To me, what that has created in our family is beautiful, in that our kids and our grandkids trust us to only speak well of them.
Yes.
And if we need to talk to them, we're going to talk to them.
Yes.
But we're not going to complain about our kids. We're not going to make, I mean, just this, the ridiculous, what did you call it? Passive aggressive stuff that parents do. You get a bunch of parents and grandparents together and you see it in full force.
Yes.
And I just love that Phil led our family in this loving way of being, that you kids can know that you are safe from criticism of us behind your back, that we are honestly, genuinely loyal to you. And if we think you're messing up, we're going to come to you because you've invited us. Each of our kids invited us to come talk to you about your parenting or about your life or anything that you see. Mm-hmm. And we take that. We take that seriously.
So, yeah, we pray for you.
Every day.
Yeah.
And that was Diane's idea. We walk our dog each morning. Now it's Diane's massive dog. Her baby boy dog is 85 pounds. But she said, why don't we make it our goal to pray for our kids and grandkids on our walks? And so, you know, I think that's the responsibility of parents and also grandparents.
Yeah.
Well, thank you everyone for your questions today. This has been a blast to answer your questions. We're excited to get more. And thank you for trusting us with these questions. Looking forward. Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If this podcast has blessed you in any way, here's a few ways that you can partner with us in this ministry. First is to give. Intentional Parents is a nonprofit, and we rely on the generous giving of our partners. So please head over to our website, intentionalparents.org/give, if you would like to become one of our partners through giving. Second is to share it. If this has at all been helpful to you, we encourage you to share it with your friends, your family, and those that you know would be blessed by it. Third is to follow us on social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. You can find us on Instagram at intentional_parents. And lastly, if you would head over to iTunes if you enjoyed today's episode and leave a review on iTunes, this helps us bring more hope, help, and healing for families.